Mental strength is perhaps the quality that sets the great apart from the good. When the pressure really comes on at the end of a competition, do we rise to the occasion or are we crushed by the expectation? Well, we've got the perfect guest to help answer your questions about mental toughness, and this is your opportunity to ask Ben Ainslie to help you with your sailing campaign. But firstly, some introductions. Hi, my name's Andy Rice, coming to you from Winchester in the UK. And Hamish, I can't keep track of where you are these days. What are you up to today?
Yeah, we're still homeless. But we're homeless on the caravan. We're camped in a beautiful spot on the shores of Lake Taupo. And we've just arrived. And I'm really excited to hear from Ben tonight. So big thanks to Ben, a great friend from yesteryears, many years, and I'll let you do the rest of the introductions, Andy. Over to you.
Well, hi Ben, thanks for joining us, and tell us, where are you in the world today?
Hey Andy, hi Hamish, hi everyone. Yeah, I'm up in Brackley, which is where the Mercedes Formula One team are based, and we got our America's Cup design group are based up here as well, which is a great spot. It's a very sort of collegiate atmosphere up here, but it is also probably about as far away from the sea as you can get in the UK. So for a sailing team to be based here is a little bit strange in that respect. But obviously the design firepower that we have here is pretty awesome.
And the thing about the America's Cup is that you say that you're quite far away from the sea, and I would think that the complexity of an America's Cup campaign, especially when you're heading up a team, Ben, means that you get further and further away from the sailing. And what's always impressed me is that when you get back in a boat, you still seem to know what you're doing. So how do you manage that? How do you, when you've got so many balls to juggle or plates to spin, whatever metaphor we want to use, how do you manage to do that?
Yeah, it is a bit tricky. But I have to say, getting back out of the water is... it's, you know, the happy place, and it's something I really, really look forward to. And I remember, and I'm sure a lot of sort of full-time sailors or, you know, Olympic sailors would identify with this, that you train so hard that you're close to burnout a lot of the time. That certainly isn't an issue for me. When I get on the water, I'm so excited to be out there that I'm sort of, you know, trying to lap up every minute I can get. And also, I'm really lucky. I've got a fantastic team around me. You know, guys like Luke Parkinson and Ian Jensen, who are right at the top of the game. So, it's just about trying to manage the time and the priorities. And certainly as we get closer towards the business end of the cup on the water, then that, for me, that job very much switches to being a sailor rather than sort of the management side of things.
Well, we might get into the specifics of how you switch your mind out of management thinking into competitive animal again. We might get back into that a little bit later. I just want to ask you if you remember a time when Hamish invited you in New Zealand along to speak to some Oppie kids, and the advice that you gave those Oppie kids is stuck in Hamish's mind ever since. And I just want to see if your recollection of your advice squares up with Hamish's. So do you remember the occasion, and do you remember what you said to those kids?
I've been fortunate to go to New Zealand a number of times over the years. The first time I went was back in 1993 for the Laser Radio World Championships, and I've had a wonderful affinity with New Zealand ever since. I don't know, it might be narrow neck yacht club or sailing club. Is that the one, Hamish, or Murray's Bay?
I can't remember. It was Murray's Bay. After we had a little dinner, a little feed at home, and then you shot down and very kindly talked to the Optimus Worlds team, which were training there. And it was really awesome what you said. I mean, it rung straight to my heart, you know, and it was also, very, very pertinent in a sense with Road to Gold, because Road to Gold is all about delivering good information and allowing people to run their own campaigns. So that allowing people to run their own campaigns is more or less what you told these kids in a nutshell.
Okay, good.
Yeah, Well, ignore the coach. I that's what you told me, he said. So some your friend, the coach Hamish Wilcox, invites you along and you tell these kids, ignore the coach.
Yeah, don't listen to him.
That's exactly it. Brilliant.
So Ben, I think when you said that, you probably meant it. And certainly Hamish and I, and you're a bit younger than us, we come from a generation when there wasn't much coaching, and I suspect that you were self-coached to a large degree as well. Things have changed quite a bit since then. Give us your view on the pros and cons of coaching at junior and youth level.
Yeah, right. Well, no, I mean, I actually was really fortunate. The club I started sailing at, the Stronger Sailing Club down there, Falmouth, there were a couple of the parents who were really good sort of national level sailors. And they just sort of volunteered their time, much like many other clubs around the world, I would imagine, parents sort of mucking in to help out. And then I got involved with the national squad, and Jim Saltonstall, who many people will know and have heard of, you know, a bit of already a legend in those times, took many of us under his wing. And I guess with Jim, it wasn't so much about the sort of technical coaching as much as, you know, I think he really instilled in everyone that passion for the sport. And also the fact that we could why couldn't we go out and win some races internationally? And, you know, there was certainly a generation of sailors, you know, you think of the last 20 or 30 years of our Olympic team, most of those would have come through Jim Saltonstall at some stage. So yeah, he had a huge part to play. But I think, you know, coming back to Hamish's point, it's about trying to help, you know, provide the youngsters with the opportunities and setting up the camps and so on, and trying to have people that can come in and show the different skill sets that these young sailors might require, whatever class of boat they're sailing. But ultimately, and the thing I learned, it probably took me, I was about 13, 14, until it sort of really triggered off for me, was when you're at these big competitions, you can't rely on the coach anymore to tell you what to do. You've got to make the decisions, you know, where you're going to start on the start line, which way you're going to go on the course. And until you start actually making those decisions, taking that responsibility yourself, then that learning process just doesn't really, you know, you're not going through that trial and error process as quickly as perhaps you should be. So I think that was the point I was trying to make. You can't, you know, the youngsters can't just rely on everybody else to do it for them. They've got to start thinking for themselves.
Exactly.
So Jim Saltonstall instilled in you and the others of that generation the sense that if you do the work and put in the training, then why wouldn't you be able to win at the highest level? But it wasn't happening much for Olympic sailing at the time, and you winning that silver, along with the silver that John Marrickson and Ian Walker won in the 470, was a big breakthrough, and that made it much easier for British sailors of that generation to believe that they could do the same. But did you always have the belief internally that you could do that, or was it a learned skill, the mental strength that you need to succeed at the top level?
No, I definitely learned. Yeah, I didn't, you know. Well, we sailed together in Lasers, didn't we, back at Stokes Bay, and there were probably, I don't know, 10, 15 sailors that were really going for it for that one spot for the 96 games. And, you know, myself, Ian Percy, Andrew Simpson, you know, Paul Goodison were sort of the youngsters coming through. You know, at that age, I was just loving the sailing, obviously had half an eye on, well, that would be amazing to get that Olympic spot, you know, really, really going for it. But the expectations weren't really there, I guess. And then I found myself in these Olympic Games in 96. I was sort of on quite a rapid rise. I just won the European Championships maybe a month before the Games and finished third at the World Championships. So I knew sort of I was had a sniff at getting a medal. Didn't really start off all that well. I think I was in the mid-20s in the first race, which is a bit of a disaster. And then managed to sort of pull myself together and ended up going into the final race with a chance, a bit of an outside chance, but a chance at the gold medal against Robert Scheidt, who was just this sort of legend, and already a legend in sailing and certainly in laser sailing. I had to sort of, it was a case of just learning as you go, really. But I think the more you get in those situations, whether you win or lose, you always take something away from it. And I think that's the thing, you know, that people should really try and, you know, make sure whatever racing they're doing is to try and learn from it. Even the sort of intense disappointments that you go through inevitably when you're racing, it isn't always going to be great. There's massive learnings in those, and it's just trying to take that, you know, take those learnings and turn it into a bit of a positive.
I was listening to Shirley Robertson's podcast with you that I think you did probably almost 2 years back, maybe. But Tim Hancock putting a really good spin on you losing that gold medal, because it sounded like you felt the loss of that gold. And he said it was the best thing that could have happened to you because it will spur you on.
He was trying to cheer me up, but he probably had a point. Yeah, it's hard in sailing, isn't it, though? Because you only get one spot per nation, obviously, at the moment. So you're never really quite sure how many chances you're ever going to get, even if you're going to be fortunate enough to even go to the Olympics. So, my response was yeah, that's the motivation to try and come back and do one better in 4 years' time. And that's what sort of drove me forwards, I guess.
Yeah. That we have got questions absolutely pouring in. I'm going to have to apologise in advance and say there's no way that we're going to get round to all the questions today. I'm also just going to switch off the Facebook Live. So if you've been following us on Facebook, find your way through to the link and get on the Zoom call, because that's the only way you'll be able to watch the rest of this call with Ben Ainslie. So we're just coming off Facebook Live now. But I'm going to put my first question to you from... Well, a certain Robert Shite, actually, Ben. We spoke to Robert last night, and we had a great call with him. And I wanted to know what he wanted to ask you. So his question is back to Athens 2004, when he recalls that you had a tough protest with a certain French guy. I think that was Guillaume Florent, and you were disqualified at the end of that race in a port starboard, quite a controversial one. So Robert says he thought it would be quite hard for you to recover from that and go on to win the gold. So your mindset, how do you wash off all that that junk, as he put it, and the protest situation? How do you clean it out of your mind and get fresh the next day and still win the gold medal?
Yeah, okay. Well, firstly, hi, Robert. I don't know if Robert's watching this or not, but he is. Hi, Robert. Hope you're doing well. Yeah, that was a tough one. I didn't have a particularly good first race. I was 10th in the first race of those games, and then I was in first or second place in the second race. And yeah, we had a really close cross on Port Tack. Close cross on Port Tack with Guillaume Florent, the French sailor. And it was one of those ones where we've all been there, you know, your crossing is tight, but you kind of know you're crossing. And, you know, Guillaume made a bit of a sort of meal of it and then said he was shouted at me or something. And then we had this sort of conversation with what are you doing? And it was nothing. And then there was nothing. And then I think about a minute before the end of the protest time, he put a protest in. So it was all a bit one of those sort of, unfortunately, that happens at the Olympics because everyone's under a lot of pressure, but yeah, so I ended up losing the protest because there was nobody else around. There was no jury boats. It was just the two of us. And in that situation, it's, the Port Tack boat's got to somehow convince the jury that there wasn't an incident. Clearly they felt I wasn't able to do that and disqualified me from the race, which was at that point, I think Robert's quite right. I kind of half of my mind felt like I'd blown it, that I wasn't going to be able to come back from that. So yeah, I was really, really frustrated. Really frustrated. Of course I felt I'd been hard done by. And yeah, I guess I was lucky. The next day, it was really windy. So they had the Meltemi in Athens, the really strong offshore breeze. and quite shifty breeze. So I was able to, I guess I was able to take my frustrations out on the boat and on the breeze. And you know, as we all know, the Finn's pretty physical boat. So that was it really. I went out, I think the next day I got two bullets and sort of got myself back on track. But yeah, it was those moments are tough. You know, you're on the back foot. You either sort of fold or you come back and to say, well, you know, no matter how bad the situation, you just got to keep fighting. And you never know. You just never know where you can get to. And I think Robert's probably one of the best examples of that in sailing, because he had phenomenal ability to come back from dire situations in any race and get himself into the points and turn a hopeless situation into something that you could sort of deal with and move on into the next day.
Stuart Keegan, one of my musto skiff mates, you've got a question that relates to this. Let's see if we can get you in, Stuart. Let's see if we can, and I'm going to ask it for Stuart anyway. It's a question about the opposite to resilience, as Stuart describes it. In what situations is it appropriate to get angry and use the pent-up energy to your advantage? And I mean, this makes me think of the closing stages of London 2012, and again, you get frustrated, Ben, by, you feel like Jonas Høegh Christensen and PJ Postma are sort of doing a bit of a job on you, and that's when they made me angry, and they don't want to make me angry quote came out. Did that release an extra level from you that might not have emerged if they hadn't have done what they did?
It maybe. I think it's very, at times it's quite subtle, isn't it? And I wasn't really sailing that well. I had some issues sort of physically, but I also wasn't really sailing that well in that event. And sometimes you need a bit of a spark to fire you up. And for me, I guess that was it. That was sort of a perfect opportunity to sort of, I guess siege mentality is an interesting term that gets used a lot in sport. There was an element of that, I suppose, that I used as a bit of a motivation. I think the Cup in 2013 was a similar situation in a team environment where Team New Zealand incredibly dominant and Oracle Team USA, we were massively on the back foot. And that then became a sort of siege mentality approach where our sort of, I guess, professional pride demanded of us to at least try and win a few races and not you know, go down straight in an America's Cup final. So yeah, there are moments when I think you just need to use it, but it you kind of got to be careful that obviously, you know, there's one famous incident in my career, I suppose, where my aggression sort of got the better of me and ended up sort of chasing after a camera boat. And that obviously is no good. So I would say, yeah, if you're going to sort of, if you feel like you've been aggrieved or you're frustrated with your performance, you know, have a moment, but get it out of get it out of your system and get it out of your system fast and use it in the right direction.
Well, we've got a question. Let's see if I can find it again. I've got so many to sort through. From Alex Van Doren, Topper Sailor, about how you reset when you're having a bad race. I hope I've got it right. Let's see if we can get you in to ask that question directly, Alex.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering how you reset after you do badly in a race, because sometimes I screw up a race by capsizing and sometimes I just don't have the will to go on.
Okay, Alex. Yeah, don't worry. We've all been there, my friend. I think it's, first thing is, if you're racing, you can never give up. No matter how bad it is, many capsizes, you've got to finish off the race, because if you start quitting, if things aren't working out, then you'll always just end up quitting. And that's a bad mindset to be in. So you just got to keep trying and you owe it to yourself, really. All the effort you're putting into it, to the preparation, kind of owe it to yourself to keep going and give it your best all the way to the end. I think that's got to be the mindset. I think if something goes wrong, whether you capsize or you get the wrong side of a big wind shift or somebody gets in your way, I think you just got to get that frustration out pretty quickly and then try and reset. And actually, even in the sailing, you know, in a team environment now, that we have, we sort of even use that word, just reset, when we have a bad moment in a race. And particularly in these races now, in the SailGP and so on, it's a 10-minute race, it all happens pretty quickly. So you haven't got time to dwell on it for too long. You kind of got to just get gather yourself and then get back on with the race. So I would say just have that process that, you know, obviously something's gone wrong. Get that frustration out pretty quickly, whether you want to have a yell at yourself or whatever, but just get it out of the system and then get that determination going to fight back and give it your best shot to the end of the race.
Great question. Thank you very much for that, Alex. Ben, I once asked one of your regular teammates, Dave Freddie Carr, about what he observes about the way that you prepare yourself for a race. And he says that you seem to have this routine at the back of the boat where you sort of have a 10 second moment to yourself. Can you talk through a routine that you go through to get yourself up ready for a race?
That's probably just 10 seconds trying to get some distance from Freddie Carr and all the chat, but no, I'm joking. No, I think that's right. It's a good point. You do need to sort of set yourself up for a race. And I suppose the process, it's easier in a sort of an Olympic type boat or single-handed or a dinghy, because you've got a bit more time to yourself in preparation. In some of the racing we do now with SailGP and so on, your time is so tight, you don't really get that much opportunity. But back in the laser and fin days, I used to be very fixed with my process and my pre-start preparation, and going through that process that then used to slowly get me in the right mindset and thinking about everything that I needed to do for the race, making sure I ticked off all the boxes of the preparation of, you know, whether it's, you know, getting the start line bias, getting the boat set up properly, checking the wind finally before the start. That sort of process, I think. If time's tighter, then yeah, just having that ability to take 5-10 seconds, whatever it is, just to make sure that you sort of clear out all the other nonsense that might be going on in your head and just get sort of tuned into the race. I think if you can find whatever process that is for you, just making sure that you're concentrating on the race and not on anything else.
And I noticed also that for you, certainly in your Olympic era, not shaving during a regatta became a thing. So you grew a beard during the course of your Olympic competitions. Is that a process that sort of turns into a ritual, turns into a superstition?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I suppose when I was a youngster, shaving wasn't really the highest priority. When I was doing an event, I used to have some crazy superstitions. I used to have this thing about going for a Chinese meal the night before the first race of a big competition. Probably Chinese food, probably not, sports nutritionists would probably have a field day with that, wouldn't they? But I certainly don't have a focus on the Chinese meal anymore, but yeah, I don't know. It's just stuff like that, I suppose. I just didn't really think about it. I wouldn't say that was necessarily part of the process of it, but certainly preparing for a race, going through those sort of pre-start routines and getting some of your head locked into the competition. And particularly is for youngsters, I think. And I certainly know I was not particularly good at it coming through the early years in Optimus. Because you're out there, of course, you're out there having fun with your friends and chasing around after each other. It took me a while to really sort of get out of that and make sure I was focused on the race and concentrating on making the right decisions. And I guess that comes back to sort of Hamish's point early on of there's a time when you've got to focus on the race and concentrate and make the decisions for yourself. And for youngsters, that's kind of can be a little bit of a hard process to go through, because again, they're there to have fun. Of course, you want them to have fun at the right times, but making that switch between having fun and going racing can be a tricky one.
There's quite a few questions coming up about a team approach as opposed to individual approach. And Nadine Kessler, you've got a really nice question on this subject. So let's see if we can get you in to ask it.
Hi. Yes, my question is in regards to if you're a skipper of the team and you want everyone to be in the same zone and get everyone into the same headspace and mind space, how do you approach that?
Yeah, hi Nadine. That's a great question. It's something I have to be honest, I wasn't particularly good at when I started coming out of single-handed sailing and started sailing with a team, because I was pretty intense and I was sort of expecting everybody else to match that intensity, and of course it doesn't work like that. People are different. People, you know, I have a great mate of mine, Matt Cornwell, who's one of my best friends, and we did a lot of match racing together, and he was at the bow, the bowman of the match race team. He's just an incredibly nice guy. People who will know him, Cat Flap is his nickname, and you look at him and he's a bit of a surfer, and he's got long blonde hair, and he sort of wanders around like he hasn't got a care in the world, and, you know, super nice to everybody and just sort of cruising through life. But actually, the more I got to know him and understand him, beneath that is he actually incredibly determined and focused and really wanting to do well and for the team to do well. But, you know, that intensity, very different level of intensity. So it took a while to sort of figure people out and work out that not everyone's going to work at my level of intensity. And as a team, we've got to find where that balance is. Where as a team, we're happy to operate. So like I said, that took a while to work out. And I think maybe there are other single-handed sailors who've sort of been through similar situations and had to work that out. So yeah, I think it is obviously all about teamwork. It's about trying to find the right balance. It's making sure that certainly if things are going wrong, again, it took me a while to work out how to deal with that, how to get the best out of people, not just sort of having a rant and shouting at people. Funnily enough, that doesn't tend to get the best out of them. So yeah, it's a really interesting process, and well, we can all always be better at it for sure in a team environment. Yeah, I think if I look back 10 years ago to when I started sailing with the team more, that's perhaps something, and interesting maybe to get Hamish's feedback, that's something where perhaps a coach could have helped me, could have helped the team a lot to go through that process, and for me personally to make that development faster, to understand better how I was affecting other people and getting the best out of the team.
Hamish, do you want to come in and comment on this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a great answer from Ben. I mean, he covers it off really well. I mean, I'm getting out of this, you know, that there's a switch that needs to turn on, and everybody's gonna, the outcome of that switch, you know, needs to take place on the boat, so everybody's ready to start racing at the same time. And I feel like that's a big learning for me, coming from Ben, you know, talking about the whole group. But yeah, I'm absolutely sure you're right, Ben. You get someone facilitating this this dialogue amongst the team, and you'll get it all happening a lot quicker. Everybody's response to pressure and response to intensity comes out differently. You know, for Ben, it's definitely a switch, and I've seen it, you know, over and over. It's 1 minute he's, you know, we've talked about the Jekyll and Hyde, and he turns into a roaring lion from something else. So everybody's got to do that, and then they've got their response to that has to fit with getting the best out of each other. So having those discussions within the team to make that happen, have someone outside facilitating those discussions, is a really good idea. Excuse me.
Great, thanks, Hamish. Sean from Malta, let's see if we can get you in to ask your question. And if you can switch on your video as well, Sean, it'd be great to see you. Hi, Sean.
Hello. So I'm basically, I just turned 15 and I started laser radio. And in 2023 in Malta, we have the Small Nation Games, which are happening. And basically, I'm preparing them always with the fitness and going on down on sailing. How do you not let the pressure get over you during the race when you start preparing for it? Because a lot of times when, you know, big events come up, normally I get a little bit nervous and I underperform.
Yeah. Well, it's great to meet you. And I've done the Middle Sea race around Malta.
Okay.
Which was a great race. I really enjoyed it. It's a beautiful place, beautiful part of the world. So, and yeah, lucky to have such a great training venue all year around. I think dealing with the pressure for the competition, the more you can compete, that's going to help because you're going to learn every time what works, what doesn't work. I think, like I was saying earlier, having a routine really helps to get yourself focus, so you don't really have time to worry about the race and worry about the pressures of the race, if you know what I mean. So if you just focus on, okay, I'm going to get out on the race course maybe half an hour, 45 minutes before the race, I'm going to try and sail a course, I'm going to work out what the start line is, what the wind's doing, currents maybe, and get into that process. So you're not sitting around really worrying about, oh, you know, this is a big race, what if I make a mistake, what if I get it wrong? And then again, once you're into the race, just trying to do what you do. And I think it's interesting. I think, did you talk about the downwind sailing? I can't remember if you mentioned that. Maybe I misheard, sorry. But the downwind sailing is really a key in fleet racing, because if you have good speed downwind, then I think that really helps you mentally, because you always feel like you got a chance to catch up. And that's quite often where most of the ground is made up and the places are made up in dinghy fleet racing, I think. So if you can work hard on your downwind technique as well, obviously you need upwind speed, but if you can get good technique in the waves downwind, get that speed so that you know you've always got a chance to come through. If you, again, going back to someone like Robert Scheidt, I mean, he was really the first guy, I think, in lasers who really showed the possibilities that from having that really good downwind speed. So that would be my advice.
Okay, thank you.
Sean, nice question. Thank you very much. Evie, you've got a question about young sailors competing in senior competition. Let's see if we can get you on. And if you can, also switch on your video so we can see you. So let's see if we can get you in on that. I'll just give Evie a little bit longer. Hamish, we got you. Hi, Evie. Have you got your video? Can you switch it on?
My question was, I was interested to hear how you approach the senior competition as such a young sailor.
Hi, Evie. How did I approach competition as a youngster?
Is this working? I'm not sure if this is working.
We hear you, we don't see you. If you can switch on your video, that would be great, but otherwise, no worries, we can still hear you. But Ben, you fire away.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, interesting. I said earlier, there was a group of us if I think back to when I was 18, we were all racing for the Olympic spot for the 96 Olympics and a really competitive fleet in the laser class in the UK. Andy was there as well. I remember we were fighting it out Stokes Bay in the winters. It was interesting actually because there was a good group of youngsters and then there was a really talented group of senior sailors who were many of them in the top 10 in the world, really. And there was an interesting clique's the wrong word, but I think the senior sailors were all really good guys and they were all I think really welcome and supportive of the youngsters coming through, but at the same time you can see that they were obviously seeing, you know, the writing was on the wall that at some point these youngsters were going to knock them out, and And so there was sort of, there were a couple of moments, I guess, where there was a bit of maybe a little bit of intimidation or so on. And then I remember I was always, I probably used to annoy the senior sailors the most, because I would sort of fire back and I was kind of determined I wasn't going to take any rubbish from these guys. So I was going to stand up for myself. But maybe there were a couple of moments where I should have just sort of backed off and not got into a sort of confrontation. But I don't think it ever really was that much of an issue. But I guess the point was, yeah, youngsters coming through, you've got to really go for it, and there's no reason why you can't win and be successful. The other thing is, well, two other points, I think. One, just the power of having a really good squad to train against, and going back to the winters in Stokes Bay on the south coast of the UK, and we had a squad of maybe 10 boats that used to turn up two or three times a week. And, you know, there wasn't really any coaching or anything like that. We used to go sailing together and sort of do sort of rabbit drills or whatever and get stuck into it. But we made some great gains through that. And also being able to, you know, at a young age, identify areas where you perhaps had a weakness and where some of the senior sailors with more experience were better or had better technique or setup or whatever. And just trying to identify that and learn from that. I'd say I did an okay job at that, but when I look back, there were certainly some areas where, again, perhaps with some specific coaching or just doing a better job of identifying where I had a weakness, I could have picked up on it earlier. For example, I was really fast downwind on the runs, but I was rubbish at the reaching legs. And it took me quite a while in the laser. It wasn't actually until sort of after the first Olympics I went to that I sort of figured out where I was going wrong with the setup of the boat. And that really did transform in many ways my sort of performance in the laser class. So yeah, I think those were sort of the two or three key experiences I had that might help.
Ben, looking back to the early parts of your career, you mentioned a weakness at reaching. Hamish in Road to Gold talks about the dirty side of our vars, which we tend to want to ignore, and we want to polish the shiny side of the vars. What other areas were you naturally not that good at, but you realised that you had to work on?
Yeah, I wasn't that good in the strong winds, upwind. I think it's probably more a physical thing as much as anything else, but for sure a little bit technique as well. Yeah, I mean, I was good in the light because I was light, and I was really good downwind. That was probably the thing that made the difference to me. I was, you know, I went like a rocket on the downwind leg, so I could, you know, go around the wind with Mark in the late teens and be sort of fifth or sixth by the bottom gate and back in a race. And you know, so I was fortunate that I had a good technique. And obviously my body weight helped me a bit downwind. And that was in the days when, like I said earlier, Robert Scheidt was really sort of transforming the laser class and the downwind sailing, and being one of those sailors that also could get onto that technique really helped me a lot. So I was sort of fortunate to figure that bit out, I guess, from studying Robert and some of the other top sailors. But yeah, reaching upwind, strong, heavy airs upwind, sailing in a chop, yeah, bits and pieces like that, I guess.
And so what was your approach to that? Did you always believe that there was a way through that and to be able to turn a weakness into a strength? Did that process of improvement come naturally to you?
Yes and no. I mean, the reaching, well, I do look back and it frustrates me to this day that it was so obvious. I mean, basically I just wasn't using enough fang, so I was using the same vang setting for the downwind for the run as I was for the reach, and obviously just losing a lot of power in the rig. And pretty obvious, and I'm sure pretty obvious to most of the sailors I was sailing around, but you know, of course they weren't going to give me the heads up. And it was a guy, Mark Littlejohn, he's a very famous laser sailor who ended up being a really good training partner of mine. Eventually, you know, after probably 4 or 5 years of him sitting on this knowledge, eventually he told me, you might just want to try using a bit more Vang on the reach, and I'm pretty sure that will help you. And it, you know, completely transformed my reach, you know, whereas I'd normally go down a reach and I'd struggle to sort of hold on to my place. All of a sudden it was just off. I was really fast on the reach. I was overtaking boats left, right and center. And yeah, and but it took me a good 4 years probably of laser sailing to figure that out, which is crazy really when I think back to it. So yeah, that was a frustration. The upwind it was just about we had the young lad earlier, the caller, you know, at that age, 15 in a laser class, it's about getting the fitness, bulking up, getting the hiking legs going, you know, really being able to get the straight leg hiking going and get that leverage. That's what's going to make probably going to make the biggest difference to the upwind performance.
Looking back to not pulling on the Vang for 4 or 5 years on the reach to the America's Cup campaigns you've done since then, and that process of exponential improvement during the 2013 campaign with BMW Oracle, or sorry, I forget what they were called then, Oracle Team USA by then. When you did the big turnaround against Emirates Team New Zealand and San Francisco, and then that crisis with Ineos before Christmas leading up to the last cup. And then I don't know what you had for Christmas lunch, but you came back in the new year and that boat was transformed. So both technically and mentally, what have you learnt from the America's Cup and the process of experimentation and improvement?
Yeah, I mean, mentally, so it goes back to the basics of just sort of not giving up, really. And it's hard in a big team environment when things really are going badly that, you know, particularly I think that the last cup with Ineos, because we weren't a defender, we weren't automatically in the finals anyway. And we had such a disastrous start with the setup of the boat and some issues we had with our foils that we, you know, we couldn't get the boat up out of the water as early as the other teams. And trying to hold the team together at that point was, I wouldn't have said it was on a knife edge, but it wouldn't have taken much for everyone to just down tools and walk out, to be honest. It was pretty bad. But the team really dug deep. I was really proud of the way the team reacted to it and sort of got us back on track somewhat. The technical side of the sport is fascinating, and Hamish knows all about this and as well, you know, that's trying to sort of open one's mind to the possibilities is really the key there, because particularly you know, if you come from a one design sailing background as I have done, okay, the fin is technical, but it, you know, it's kind of certainly way more one design than America's Cup. It's just incredible the performance differential in any boat, really, if you can open up the design. And you know, that was an obvious one. When you look back at our team in the last cup, we were so bad. Okay, we made quite a lot of modifications to the boat between the end of the sort of Christmas race and into the end. But you know, the boat really transformed. I mean, we still had a long way to go to get up to the level of Team New Zealand. And frankly, you know, with our design package in the end, we weren't going to get there. But just the difference, the performance gains that we were able to find, again, highlights what's on the table. And you've got to keep pushing to try and evolve to find those gains, because they're definitely there. You can't just sort of assume that you put the boat in the water, that's a done deal, and that's the performance, and that's it. You've really got to go searching for those gains in the setup of the boat.
Right. Let's take it back to the mental game again. And, well, actually, there's quite an interesting question here from Noah Sangalin. So let's get you in, see if you can ask your question about self-confidence. There, Noah. So I'll ask it anyway, Ben. How do you grow your self-confidence? Again, is that something that you think you started from a fairly high base with?
Oh, yeah. It's an interesting question. I guess interesting term. I've always tried. Not sure if it always has come across that way, but I've always tried to be relatively humble, because, you know, I obviously love sport. I sort of take a lot from observing other sports people, and my observation is that the really top performers are not sort of the ones that are sort of shouting about how great they are, and, you know, they're just getting on with the job. So I think it's about, obviously, you need the experience, and with those results, if you can get some good results, that obviously gives you the belief that you can compete and you can perform at the highest level and get the results. But I think it's really important that you realize that you've always got to keep learning and improving, because there'll always be somebody else that's not far behind you, that will, if you relax for a moment, they will, you know, they'll knock you out. So it's a tricky balance between believing, obviously you've got to believe in yourself, and particularly when the chips are down, you got to just keep going back to the processes that you know have served you well in the past, and have that determination, but also never get ahead of yourself and think that you sort of got as far as you can get and you can't keep learning and improving. I think it's a delicate balance to get right.
Mohammed has a question. Mohammed, if you can join us on audio and video, let's get you to ask it directly.
Yes. Hello, Ben.
Hi.
Hi. I'm Mohammed from Egypt. I have a sailor preparing him to next solo championship in Optimus class. How I can prepare him as a mentor before World Championship?
So I was struggling with the line a bit. It's about preparing the sailor for the World Championship. Is that right, young sailor?
Yes.
Yeah. From a mental perspective. So Mohammed is asking specifically the mental preparation aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. How old is he, Mohammed?
14.
14. Yeah. I think I'm sure you're going through all the training and preparation for the race and so on, which is great. I think depending on where the race is, what the conditions are like, trying to be specific about that would for sure be helpful. And you know, I think again, sort of going back to the downwind capabilities, if you can focus on having good speed downwind as well to quite often make some of those gains if things aren't going that well in a race, that's always strong. Specific venue preparation would be important. I think trying to help the sailor not feel too much pressure, just going back to sticking to their processes, not worrying about the fact that it's a big race, just keep doing, going back to your processes, using that as a way to get focused for the race. And then whatever happens in the race, just keep going, just keep fighting, trying to do your best, looking for opportunities. I go back to when I was a youngster racing, 13, 14, try not to get too distracted by all the other stuff that's going on, you know, with friends and all the rest of it. You know, have a great time off the water, but when they get on the water, try and get them to just focus on the racing. And again, using those processes, pre-race preparation, as a way to get focused on the race, I think it's a good way to do it. Hopefully that helps. Is there any? Yeah. Okay.
Mohammed, thanks very much for the question. Jan Chu, you've got a question for Ben about the approach to psychology. Do you want to come in and ask that question?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to hear, I guess, you know, what kind of study or, you know, what, I guess, any help or like professional help from like psychologists or mental skills coach, or any tips you got for, you know, for either doing it self help yourself or you know seeking it out as well?
Yeah, hi Jen. That's great question. I unfortunately, when I was a youngster, I got introduced. I wasn't sort of forced to do it, but I was sort of, it was sort of suggested that I should go and sit with a sports psychologist. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, this sports psychologist didn't have a great impression on me. So I sort of came away thinking it was a bit of a waste of time, and it wasn't that helpful. And so I guess in a way that forced me to go through a lot of these processes myself and just try and figure that out myself. But of course, I think for all of us, as we mature in our lives, we realize just how, you know, psychology drives everything, doesn't it? And yeah, for sure. When I look back, with the right support, I'm sure I would have benefited from some more support in that area. And maybe just being a youngster and feeling that I sort of didn't need any of that nonsense and I knew better and I could work it out myself. With the benefit of hindsight, I'm sure, like I said, I'm sure I would have probably benefited from the right support. So yeah, trying to find that, what that is, doesn't necessarily need to be a psychologist, I would say. Just like, you know, a coach with the right approach can certainly help a young sailor think about their approach to the sport, not just the sport, just the life in general, really, and what's important to them, how to go about that, how to interact with other people. There's so much there, of course, isn't there, that we can and are still learning and developing, even as adults. So yeah, I think it's there are so many opportunities. So I would definitely be an advocate for trying to work on that and find the right, you know, everyone's different, aren't they? So just for that individual youngster, trying to find the right solution that would work for them.
You used to work very closely with David Sid Howlett in the Finn. You've credited Sid with getting you up to speed extremely quickly with the Finn, because he understood the boat inside out so well. He was a great Finn sailor in his own right and had already helped Ian Percy get to the gold medal at Sydney 2000. But correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, but I think Sid was not big on psychologists, and yet I heard that Sid was one of the best psychologists there is. So he may not have self-identified as one, but how did he help you apart from the technical side? How did he help you with the psychology of racing?
Yeah, well, he was probably a bit like myself, I suppose, a generational sort of thing, maybe, that, you know, you didn't need sports psychologists. Just got to harden up, but I think there's definitely a role to be had there for sure. But no, Sid was great because again, like Hamish, had experience of competing at the very highest level and what that was like and the pressures that come with that. And he was very, very good in the competition of particularly when things weren't going well, of just not reacting to it. It was just, doesn't matter, it's just normal, it's just going to happen, don't worry about it, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. And there was never any, no matter how dire the situation, certainly I think back to London 2012, where, you know, really halfway through that competition, it wasn't looking that good. But there was no panic, you know, it was just business as usual, really. So very good in that respect, obviously very good technically, and helping me make that development from a pure one design class into the Finn class. Also, you know, a great guy to sort of be on the road with, to be campaigning with, and, you know, perhaps some of the stories came around too many times, but you know, it's just great to someone with so much experience in life and everything else to hear some of those stories. And, you know, I think he'd probably kill me if I said sort of a bit of a father figure, but, you know, not far off that, really. And there were lots of moments where I had issues in my personal life that not nothing to do with sailing, that I could speak to Sid and ask for his help, his advice. And no, he was great guy.
Hamish, what are your observations of hanging out with Sid? He's certainly a character, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's like Ben said, you know, you spend so much time on the road with each other. You know, you need to be able to get on, you need to be able to entertain. And he was good at both.
We have one last question from Rose Lee, if you want to come in and ask your question. And I just want to say thank you to all the amazing questions we've had. I'm sorry we haven't been able to get on to all of them. There's just been far too many pull through the chat box. But Rose Lee, you've got first refusal on the last question. Otherwise, I'll throw it to somebody else if we can't get you in. Oh, so you want me to ask it for you? That's a shame. I wanted to get you on, Rose Lee. But Ben, have you had a time in a regatta where you were just mentally challenged? And how did you go about it? So we've addressed some of this. But maybe Sid wasn't next to you. We can think about a regatta where Sid wasn't there as the sounding board.
Right. Just trying to think back to...
Well, there's an awful lot, aren't there? And
yeah, there are.
I mean, I'm thinking out of your five Olympic campaigns, there was only one that you won fairly straightforwardly, and that to me is Beijing 2008. Would that be right in your mind? And all four of the others, I mean, which for you is the most extraordinary, and what gives you the most pride in terms of the way that you came back from a shaky start to actually end up winning the medal that you did?
Yeah, I think probably 2012, yeah, because I didn't really have any right to be there, to be honest, because I just, you know, I'd had some issues with my back. I had some back surgery in January. My fitness wasn't there, my weight wasn't there, and you know, Weymouth in that summer, and it was a breezy week and pretty straightforward racetrack, so it just came down you know, came down to sort of straight line upwind speed. And I, you know, I just didn't have it against the guys like Jonas Christensen and PJ Possmer in particular. And, you know, they were, hats off to them, they were sailing really, really well. So it was only really through pure determination that I managed to sort of hang in there and get into that medal race with, you know, a chance of getting the gold. And then that, you know, that played out pretty down to the wire. You know, I was in a good position halfway through the race. I was sort of in control. And then things sort of turned a bit inside out in the race, as we saw with the star class as well, with Ian and Bart. I mean, that was, you know, a crazy race where they were in a fantastic position and the race sort of just turned inside out on them. And a bit like that, I managed to stay in front of Jonas. But PJ was sort of hung it out on the left-hand side of the course and got himself in with a really good shot and at the gold medal. So, yeah, I think that was a great, for me, I was sort of, you know, just, it was just a good lesson in just hanging in there and just keep fighting all the way to the end.
And so you've still got a big fight ahead of you, and that is to win the America's Cup. You've won it as part of a team with Oracle, but you've still got to win that in your own right as the head of your own team. How much fight have you got left in you for that battle?
Yeah, well, that is definitely using the defeats as motivation to come back and get the job done, because it's the America's Cup, particularly sort of starting a new team. Developing the intellectual property is what's particularly difficult, because now top level yacht design is all effectively comes down to simulation tools, design tools, which you can sort of buy them off the shelf, but they'll never be quite as good as what, you know, a team like Team New Zealand have developed over what, probably 15 years now. So there's an element of catch up, and that's really difficult. And so trying to build the team, build that intellectual property, get the right people involved. It's a good challenge. That's, yeah, like I said, we've had some disappointing times, but we, yeah, you just have to use that frustration, that disappointment as the motivation to keep going, trying to learn. Big learnings there for sure in what we haven't got quite right, and try and rectify that and keep moving forward.
And it all stems back to, well, really being a little bit light in the laser, having some great downwind speed, great downwind technique. You managed to convert that into an incredible Olympic career, and now you find yourself at the head of this huge organization. And coming back to the beginning of our conversation, sailing is still your happy place, but you don't get a lot of opportunity to do that. And how much do you keep on having to find that mental resilience to get good at things that you probably never envisaged you'd have to do? You know, sitting in boardrooms, having grown-up conversations about spreadsheets and figures, and it's a long way from, you know, carving your way downwind in a laser, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is, but it's fascinating. You know, it's really, really is to build a team, to work. Again, I sort of come back to the team that we've got here. Even at the sort of management level, it's really important to have great people that you can work with, you can identify with, that are great in their own right at what they do. You know, we've got a guy called Dave Endine who's effectively runs the team day in, day out. And he and I didn't really know each other that well until about a couple of years ago. And now we have a great relationship. He's a fantastic guy. Does a brilliant job helping, we support each other really in terms of running the team. And particularly as I get more into getting on the water, I'll lean on that support more and more. And then meeting some fascinating people, you know, like Jim Ratcliffe, who backs the America's Cup team. It's just an incredible character, both in terms of his business sort of prowess, I guess, but also a person that just got an incredible zest for life and taking on these amazing challenges, and whether it's sort of trekking across the Arctic or cycling across Africa or whatever crazy thing it is he wants to try and have a go at, including the America's Cup. So yeah, it's I think life is there's some amazing opportunities out there, and I guess I'm very fortunate through sailing to have been given some of those opportunities and meet some amazing people, be part of a team with some amazing people, and most importantly for all of us, I think on this call we would say keep learning, keep developing.
Awesome. Hamish, any final comments from you before we let Ben get back to his day job?
Yeah, no, we're running over time. I'll be pretty short, but I just love the call, Ben. Lots of nuggets of wisdom. To me, it's like I got out of it the process, the routines, you know, focusing on the process, switching on and switching off, which you do so well. So thanks so much for an amazing insight to your mind.
Great to see you guys. And thanks for having me along. And all the best to everyone that's called in. Have a good season of racing ahead.
Well, you've summed it up beautifully. We've had some great questions, a lot of comments thanking you for your time, Ben. Great to see you again. Have a fantastic 2022. And I look forward to catching up with you very soon. And I look forward to catching up with all of our audience next week for a call with Stu Bithell, a gold and silver medalist. So we will be back to you in a week's time. But for now, that's it from me and Hamish. And thanks once again to Ben Ainslie. Bye for now.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.